Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the August 8th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners, as I shall do on August 29th. It has been more than 2,500 years since the Greek dramatist Aeschylus wrote that in war the first casualty is truth. Nothing has occurred over that span of time to prove him wrong. It's not a quote I think of often because, as was evident with Iraq well before the first bomb fell, that the Bush administration's war would be based on a tissue of lies. The war in Afghanistan fooled a lot of people, still does, but that too was based on lies. Syria, however, is something else. That is due to maybe to rapid advances in the age of handheld digital electronics and the multitude of outside players with perfidious agendas beginning with Washington and ending with Al-Qaeda. They have intervened in Syria and turned what began as a legitimate, nonviolent pro-democracy movement against a dictatorship determined to hold on to power into a bloody civil war. The reports that we hear on Al Jazeera and NPR from anti-regime activists cannot be verified, and some have been found to be outright falsehoods by UN inspectors. Some have not hesitated to employ some of the same tricks of the pre-digital age. For example, in late May, the BBC posted a photo on its news website under the heading "Syria Massacre in Hula Condemned as Outrage Grows," which depicted five tightly bunched rows believed to show the bodies of children in Hula awaiting burial. The caption states that the photograph was provided to BBC by a quote-unquote activist and cannot be independently verified. It was, in fact, taken on March 27, 2003, by photographer Marco Di Lauro, and it shows dozens of body bags containing skeletons found in a desert south of Baghdad at the beginning of the Iraq War. How many more photographs and videos sent by anti-government activists have been phony or staged? We'll probably never know. This is all my way of explaining why, up to now, more than a year into the Syrian conflict, I have not done a program on the subject. I haven't known who or what to believe, and those writing about Syria have, for the most part, approached the subject from either side, from a preconceived ideological basis. What I was hoping to find was a professional journalist with more solid knowledge of the country, its people, and its political history. And for former ABC chief Middle East news chief Charles Glass, I found such a person, and I'm going to be speaking with him from his home in London at about 20 minutes past the hour. So stay tuned. Back in 1966, when Bob Dole was challenging Bill Clinton's bid for a second term, the competition for the title "Who Loves Israel the Most" between the two became so embarrassing, if not grotesque, that some Jewish leaders publicly asked both of them to quit their pandering. That's not the case anymore. They can't seem to get enough of it. President Obama passed the grotesque stage long ago, and Romney, despite being adopted by the Jewish uber-right and the rapidly growing ultra-Orthodox community, is desperately playing catch-up. Since my last program, having enraged the entire population of Britain with a condescending appraisal of its Olympic Games preparedness, Romney escaped to Israel. Given the ignorant comments he would later make in Poland, Israel's probably the only country in the world where he won't be booed. One of the first things he did upon arriving in Jerusalem was to effectively promise to turn over his foreign policy portfolio and war-making powers to Prime Minister Netanyahu should he be elected. What more could he do as a candidate for someone he declared to be an old friend? Then he donned a yarmulke for a photo op at the Western Wall, dropped by a $50,000 plate breakfast arranged by his newfound sponsor, Sheldon Adelson, from which the press was barred, and later told his host that it was by dint of their superior culture and not their U.S.-provided F-16s, Apache helicopters, not the billions of U.S. tax dollars, or America's unconditional support of Israel in the international arena that Israelis held sway over the Palestinians. He then added that it was the same difference in cultures that made the difference between the relative successes of the U.S. and Mexico, a statement that will certainly endear him to the country's Mexican-American voters. In the same speech to an audience of 500, he declared that, quote, "The security of Israel is in the vital national security interest of the United States. We serve the same cause and we provoke the same hatreds and the same enemies," end quote. It should be noted at this point that beginning with the election of Bill Clinton, and is purging of anyone with any connections to the Middle East from the State Department, what Israel supporters pejoratively refer to as Arabists, the White House has made Israel's enemies America's own, something that is rarely mentioned even by the government's left critics. Back in Jerusalem, to no one's surprise, Romney never mentioned Israel's settlements or the Israeli-Palestinian so-called peace process. As expected, the first section of his speech focused on the threat of a nuclear-armed Iran, which has been a major theme of Romney's foreign policy statements. Preventing a nuclear Iran is America's, quote, highest national security priority, he said. It would be foolish not to take the leaders of Iran at their word. We have a moral imperative to deny Iran's leaders the means to follow through on their malevolent intent, end quote. That neither Iranian President Ahmadinejad nor the Ayatollah Khamenei have ever threatened to initiate a war in Israel or the United States is as irrelevant to Romney as it is to Obama and to the mainstream media. In his meeting with Israeli President Shimon Peres, Romney said the threat that Iran would pose to Israel, quote, the region and the world is incomprehensible and unacceptable, end quote. He didn't go as far in his words, at least publicly, as did Dan Senor, his senior foreign policy advisor and liaison to the Jewish community. Hours before Romney's speech, Senor said that if elected, Romney would support a unilateral Israeli strike on Iranian nuclear facilities. Quote, if Israel has to take action on its own in order to stop Iran from developing the capability, the governor would respect that decision, Senor told a news briefing. If the name Dan Senor sounds familiar, it should. The former AIPAC intern, whose sister runs the AIPAC office in Israel, was a press spokesperson for Paul Bremer, the Bush-appointed administrator for Iraq after the U.S. invasion. It should be no surprise to find him talking up another war for Israel. His boss Romney seemed to think that Israel's welfare and that of its people should be near and dear to the heart of every American, and he chided the president, who he says has failed it. Speaking at the Veterans of Foreign Wars National Convention in Reno on the eve of his visit to Israel, Romney accused Obama of having, quote, undermined their position, which was tough enough as it was. And even at the United Nations, to the enthusiastic applause of Israel's enemies, he went on, he spoke as if our closest ally in the Middle East was the problem. The people of Israel, he said, deserve better than what they have received from the leader of the free world, end quote. Obama's staunch support of Israel is never enough for his ideological neoconservative detractors, Jacob Heilbrunn wrote in the National Interest magazine. Obama, quote, condemned the Palestinian drive for statehood at the UN. Not enough. He awarded Israel $3 billion in military assistance, an all-time high. Not enough. He repeatedly avowed his commitment to Israel's security and well-being. Still not enough, end quote. It was left to a self-declared Zionist, our Vice President Joe Biden, to respond to Romney's charges. Said Biden, quote, we provided record levels of security assistance, funding for the Iron Dome missile system, we had intercepted nearly 80% of the rockets recently fired from Gaza, close collaboration on longer-range missile defense systems, the largest joint military exercises in history, the most consistent and comprehensive exchanges ever between our top political defense, security, and intelligence officials, end quote. To top that off, the day before Mitt arrived to glad hand his Israeli friends, Jared Bernstein, President Obama's liaison to the Jewish American community, sent what he titled, quote, White House Update for the American Jewish Community, which began, quote, friends, Friday, President Obama continued to demonstrate his unwavering support for Israel's security, signing into law the United States-Israel Enhanced Security Cooperation Act of 2012 and announcing an additional $70 million for the Iron Dome missile defense system. You can read a blog post on the White House American Jewish Community page about the bill. Yesterday, he said, the president approved a new executive order imposing sanctions against the Iranian energy and petrochemical sectors, as well as announcing steps to hold responsible institutions that knowingly enable financial transactions for designated Iranian banks, end quote. Well, I read enough of that. The post went on and on in the same vein. As you might have guessed, there is no White House page or update for any other American community. On my last program, you'll recall, I reported on a startling revelation by frequent guest and investigative journalist Grant Smith, whose IRMEP, or Institute for Research, Middle East as Israel Lobby Archive site, is the very best on the internet for discovering the hidden history of U.S.-Israel relations. His latest report, backed by FBI documents released on June 27th and featured on the antiwar.com website, revealed that the Israeli contact for Richard Kelly Smythe, who was convicted of smuggling 800 nuclear triggers or Kritons to Israel in 1985, was the current Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. Big story, no? No. Major headlines? No. Not in the U.S., where the major media and important segments of the alternative media are either, like Congress, in the pocket of the Israel lobby or frightened by it. Even when it was reported accurately in at least two Israeli newspapers, it was blanked out here. On the Friday before Romney arrived in Israel, Grant hoped to get some discussion on the topic during a call-in portion of Diane Rehm's weekly news roundup on WAMU, the Capitol's NPR station. Rehm's program is distributed nationally by NPR and reaches 2.2 million listeners across the country, and she has won numerous honors, including the Peabody Award, for her 30 years in public radio. Her guests that Friday when Grant Smith called in were Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson of NPR, Warren Strobel of Reuters, and Elise Labat of CNN. Here's how it went. Besides Diane Rehm's introduction, the voice you will hear responding to Grant is that of Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson, who is familiar to all NPR listeners. Let's give a listen.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. Thousands of Syrians flee the city of Aleppo in fear of a renewed assault by government troops. Across Iraq, a division of al-Qaeda launches attacks that kill more than 100 people. Egypt's new president chooses an American-educated technocrat as prime minister. The head of the European Central Bank pledges to preserve the euro. And today marks the official start of the Summer Olympics in London. Joining me for this week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson of NPR, Warren Strobel of Reuters, and Elise Labat of CNN. Do join us with your questions and comments, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll come back. We'll go right back to the phones to Grant in Washington, D.C. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Since early July, Israeli news outlets have just been ablaze with reports on an FBI file released implicating Netanyahu in nuclear trigger smuggling from the United States, specifically the Kriton caper. It's been all over alternative news sites in the U.S., like antiwar.com.
You know, I haven't seen anything of that.
I've been in Israel for the last 7 weeks, and truthfully, I haven't seen anything.
All right, let's go to St. Louis, Missouri.
So there you have it. Not even a hint of journalistic curiosity. It's a minefield out there, and professional journalists in this country have to be very careful where they walk, and what they talk. If you want to see the FBI documents for yourself, go to Grant Smith's website, irmep.org/ILA. And one Associated Press story that did make some of the smaller U.S. papers and made headlines in Haaretz in Israel was a report by the Associated Press that the CIA considers Israel to be the Mideast's biggest spy threat. The article describes how the CIA station chief opened the locked box containing a sensitive equipment he used from his home in Tel Aviv to communicate with CIA headquarters in Virginia, only to find that someone had tampered with it. The incident, described to the Associated Press by three former senior U.S. intelligence officials, might have been dismissed as just another cloak and dagger incident in the world of international espionage, except that the same thing had happened to the previous station chief in Israel. Such meddling underscores what's widely known but rarely discussed outside intelligence circles, the Associated Press article went on. Despite inarguable ties between the U.S. and its closest allies in the Middle East, and despite statements from U.S. politicians trumpeting the friendship, the CIA considers Israel its number one counterintelligence threat in the agency's Near East Division. This means, the Associated Press article concludes, the CIA believes that U.S. national secrets are safer from other Middle Eastern governments than from Israel.